Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, salam, and welcome to the podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel with the New Books Network. This is your co-host, Shahna Saqani. Today, our conversation is with Celine Ibrahim about her new book, Women and Gender in the Quran, published with Oxford University Press in 2020. Ibrahim earned her PhD in Arabic and Islamic Civilizations at Brandeis University. She's editor of One Nation Indivisible, Seeking Liberty and Justice from the Pulpit to the Streets, published with WIF and Stock Publishers in 2019. She's currently working on a manuscript that explores the concept of monotheism in Islamic intellectual history, which is forthcoming with Cambridge University Press. In Women and Gender in the Quran, Ibrahim explores key themes related to gender in the Quran, focusing on women such as female sexuality, female kin and relations, and female figures in the sacred text. Among her findings is that there are no archetypal women in the Quran, and instead, the Quran provides a wide-ranging depiction of women who figure as negative and positive exemplars and ultimately serve the specific didactic aims of the Quranic narrative. The Quran invokes their good and bad examples, Ibrahim notes, especially to construct a moral framework for its immediate audience, the early Muslim community, the emerging polity. In our discussion, she talks about the primary contributions of the book and its origins. She explains her choice to use a Quran-only approach to investigating the question of gender, and we discuss specific content from the book, such as the Quran's portrayal of daughters and mothers, women's speech, Muhammad's wives in the Quran, the concept and the gender of heavenly beings, such as the Hur, and a lot more. This here is my conversation with Celine Ibrahim. Hi, Celine. Thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your book, Women and Gender in the Quran.
Hi, Shahnaz. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So it is our tradition on the New Books podcast to ask our guests to tell us about their intellectual journey and how they got here. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, so my intellectual journey in terms of Islamic studies is a bit of a combination of having a traditional background and coming to the text as a Muslim who lives this as a devotional practice, and then also studying Islam through academic means. And so I think for those who approach the book, they can see a bit of both of those influences coming through.
Nice. And how did the book come about and why now?
I can remember being in a classroom in a graduate school with Leila Ahmed, and it was the first time that I had thought about gender and Islam in a sustained way. And we were looking at the tradition of having concubines in Islamic law. And I think that was, for the first time for me, this opening into what it meant to be a woman specifically in Islam. And since that point, I think for me anyway, there was always some type of intellectual struggle between what I was discovering, coming to texts and traditions from a more historical critical perspective, and then just my practice of being a Muslim. And so in many ways, when I was you know, deciding on my first book-length project, I wanted it to be a project where I could continue to explore some of those questions that I had, you know, those places where my own practice met kind of the intellectual history, and that caused me some friction. And at the same time, I thought that it would also be beneficial for others who were also potentially, you know, in their practice as Muslims, having particular questions regarding gender.
Hmm. For sure. I think this book would be, and not I think, I know this book, and I was just talking to some colleagues about this and friends about this, that it would be such, and it is such an excellent and also very liberating read for a lot of, for Muslims who, for academics too, I'm sure, but for non-academic Muslims who are looking for a, you know, women-centric interpretation of the Quran, something that puts women at the center, and some of the conclusions that you make and the interpretations that you offer, I think can be very freeing for a lot of us. So thank you for this.
I also have to give Omid Safi a little credit here, because very early on in my graduate studies, I had presented a paper, and after hearing the paper, he had come to me and we started a discussion, and essentially, you know, he said it much more eloquently like this, but this is what my memory distilled is, you know, there's so many positive things to focus on about women in Islam. Why have you only chosen, you know, this whole list of negatives? And that for me kind of set me in a different trajectory. And so I just kind of wanted to give him credit for that, for taking, you know, aside a young graduate student and really opening up a horizon of potential. And I think in many ways, when I set about doing the book, of course, I set about doing it as an academic, you know, as a research project. But at the same time, I did also, you know, want to imbue the writing with a particular type of, as you say, maybe like a liberating spiritual perspective.
Mm-hmm. So since there's a lot of wonderful scholarship on women and gender in the Quran currently, I'm wondering if you could tell our audience a little bit about what makes your book different, what interventions you're making and where, and whether the book, your book fits into, or how this book fits into this broader literature.
Yes, in my earlier work and with the field in general, much of the writing about women in the Quran was focused more on a legalistic perspective. And for me, there's only so far that can go in terms of the capturing more of the fullness of the depiction of women in the Quran. So legal verses are one sort of genre, but stories are, you know, as you know, a large portion of the Quran. And I knew that there was work out there that looked at specific stories in detail. And I know that there were some earlier accounts to at least pull together. I'm thinking of the work of Stowasser and later Amina Wadud. But I didn't find a book out there that I would say want to give to my daughters or my friends or my students. And so I sort of set out to write that book that would distill in as comprehensive a way as possible the tropes and themes about women figures, you know, making that distinction between woman as a category that then has a type of legal valence from this genre of just, you know, stories and what are, you know, women characters like when we look at their, you know, not just deeply at one particular story, but as a cohort, if you will.
Mm-hmm. No, some of the themes you cover, I couldn't think of. And the only thing that I could think of actually that relates to gender that doesn't get covered in here is men. No, I mean, only in relation to women, they do, of course. But, you know, given that gender, it turns out men too shockingly have a gender, and we talk about gender today, but still focus on women. And so other than men and masculinity as a theme, which you do address in the conclusion briefly, but it's pretty, I mean, you have a, you talk about female sex and sexuality. You talk about sexual slander, sexual assault, otherworldly sexualities. You talk about female kin relations, procreation, parents. It's really, really comprehensive. It's incredible.
I'm about 80 pages into a manuscript on men and gender in the Quran. So we'll see where that project goes. You know, it might take me another 10 years, but it is currently in the works to some degree.
Very exciting to hear. So can you walk us through some of the essentials, like the frameworks and the methodology of the book, how you're approaching the question of gender and women in the Quran to ground your analysis?
Great. Generally. Yeah. So the first decision point I really had to make was, you know, who is counting as a woman figure here? And that I decided would include women who are mentioned in parables, such as the woman figure who, you know, unties the knots or, you know, how we translate that is in dispute, but you know, these small mentions, so a woman figure in just one verse. And then my second question was, how do I deal with the women figures that are extrapolated much more so in the tafsir tradition than they are in the Quran? And I pretty early on decided that the bulk of my focus, because I was really interested in the Quran itself as sort of this literary, revealed text for Muslims as a complete corpus in and of itself, I decided that while I would engage tafsir, that I would actually keep that to a minimum so that I could actually do as much justice as possible to the verses that I was looking at. Because when I started enumerating them, I was over 300 verses that I found relevant to this particular study. And so I didn't want to bog myself down so much in the tafsir tradition, and particularly because that had been done by previous authors, looking at specific stories. And so I felt that that resource was already out there in different forms. But the actual way in which figures contrast with each other, for instance, looking at the figure of Zulaykha and thinking about how other women in the Quran who are portrayed as sexually chaste, how they compare and contrast with her figure. And so I thought there was a lot that was in the Quran, itself to dig into beyond, without going beyond too much into the tafsir. And of course, especially in the later chapters, when I'm talking about more of the stories of the women in Medina, or for instance, even in the early Meccan surah that discusses the wife of Abu Lahab, I need some tafsir, but I really just took from tafsir the very basic outlines of stories. I didn't center, so to speak, the commentator's interpretation of the stories. I really tried to look very closely at what was in the text itself, the Quran, and limit myself as much as possible to that.
Speaking of which, I want to take a moment to address this larger question of gender and or women in the Quran. When we use only the Quran as a source of our interpretation, which I completely recognize as a completely legitimate and valid and often even necessary task, what exactly does such a task say about the role of text and especially of scripture? Because are we trusting and expecting the text to make complete sense outside of any context? Because I feel like a lot of these verses and themes that you talk about have context, and I'm not talking about context, I'm not talking necessarily about socio-historical or political contexts in which these verses are revealed, but I'm also talking about verses that are part of a larger surah, right? Or a larger theme in a specific surah. So the way that women talk, for example, is also very similar to the way that men talk, something like that, right? And I wonder what we lose when we focus on a specific verse or a word without contextualizing it in, say, the larger surah or the theme of that surah. So can you share some thoughts with us on what you were aiming for by looking at each verse and gender theme on its own and using that specific verse alone To make your point, is it even really possible to interpret the Quran using the Quran alone?
Yes, I like to think about it as different layers of meaning. So you're going to get one type of reading if you're just looking at the Quran alone, and there's going to be value in that. I mean, that's my conviction, sort of both as a practicing Muslim and just as a scholar of the text. And so, you know, for instance, what I'm doing with the heavenly beings in paradise, that's just looking at the text alone and trying to say, you know, what sort of depiction, you know, taking away the backdrop of, you know, many centuries of writing and interpretation on this subject, you know, as much as possible, what are we getting from this, you know, different lens, this different approach that is Quran only. And it's not that I'm advocating in an ultimate sense that is the only or the best way to read. I just think it's a modality of reading, specifically when it comes to the women figures, that has been totally overlooked, you know, in favor of a tafsir, you know, tradition and that particular approach, which tends to extrapolate stories maybe beyond their Quranic context a bit. And so that's what I was interested in, just more providing a multiplicity of readings, providing a depth that a Quran-only approach makes possible. And again, I wasn't finding it in devotional Muslim context so much because of the influence and the weight of the tafsir tradition, but I also wasn't finding it in academic approaches to the Quran. I think because there has been an emphasis on maybe reading the Quran through the tafsir tradition rather than just kind of reading the Quran, you know, for its own sake. So there remains just so much work to be done, I think, taking that methodological approach. And again, it's not, you know, for the devotional, you know, audience, I don't mean to be undermining the tafsir tradition at all. I just think that there's additional insights that are still, you know, in the Quran, ready to be mined, that the tafsir tradition, you know, it has not exhausted.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. You know, and let's be real here, the tafsir tradition is very, very masculine, and it's by men, and or the stuff that's remained that's left for us, right? And so the stuff that survived, I mean. And so when they're going to interpret it in ways like the whole discussion, I found very convincing in your book, because it's the fact that you tell us it's not this feminine gendered being, which I'll come back to this later in specific questions about that, but the tafsir tradition completely disagrees, and it's because they're coming at it from a very, very different perspective. And also they're men who are putting their, you know, their own selves and interests into the text. And we've seen a lot of evidence of that. And I think Amina Wadud and you also do a very good job explaining how sort of, you know, we read things into the Quran anyway. But that also then brings me to say, your response, which is very helpful, also makes me wonder about the role that this book is, what you see as the role that you see this book to be playing in Muslim readers' lives, and how you might respond to those, and by those I mean here specifically these devotional Muslims that you're thinking of, the same folks who might find something, a book like this, very liberating, right, very freeing, who would say, well, maybe the Quran doesn't gender, say, the hur, but the hadiths do. How do we deal with something like that? Or if you have any thoughts at all to share, we don't have to talk about this at all.
This is pretty idiosyncratic of my approach, but I feel like I was never really trained well as a hadith scholar. And so it is a realm that I've not, you know, specifically claimed to have expertise in the same way. And so I think it's for maybe my future work, maybe someone else's work, to look more closely, you know, in a as comprehensive a way as possible about themes of gender in the hadith, because some of these questions can't be answered by just looking at a small subset. It really needs to be comprehensive and holistic to try to understand, you know, from a scholarly perspective or from a devotional perspective, you know, what these texts, not only what they're saying to maybe their initial audience, but what they're supposed to be saying to a contemporary audience. And you know, for me, there's a, you know, to say that I'm not qualified to look at Hadith, firstly, I'm not qualified from an academic perspective, and I'm also not qualified in terms of a devotional Muslim perspective either. And, you know, maybe that's qualifications that I'll eventually pursue sometime in life. But I think it's important to, you know, when we're working, whether in the whether in academia or, you know, in other spheres, in kind of contemporary religious communities, to know our boundaries and to know what areas we are experts in and what areas we might be doing more harm if we try to assert a particular claim. Like, I have not done the work to sufficiently probe that issue. And, you know, it needs to be done, of course. So maybe I'm the one to do it. Maybe there's someone else out there who has that particular interest.
Also, it also raises a lot of important questions about once we find evidence about a particular something like a fact in the Quran, why are we so invested in sort of challenging that and saying, well, I don't think, why do we want to contradict that using a different source like the Hadiths, which are secondary to the Quran? Like, you know, Muslims agree that the Quran is the most superior of all the sources of Islam. So it would then raise a lot of questions about what relevance does the Quran end up serving after all, if we're not looking at it as a primary source, you know, for understanding something like gender in this case. But
yeah, and another way of asking the question is, what's at stake? And so for me personally, in asking the question about the Hur and trying to see what the Quranic depiction precisely was, it was a question of, you know, does God care in an ultimate sense about, you know, women's, you know, desires, or, you know, to put it kind of in a crude way. And I think, you know, for me personally, when I'm approaching the work, I am approaching it with questions that are kind of partly intellectual curiosities, but partly come out of my work. I didn't mention it yet, but I served as a chaplain for many years in a college setting. And, you know, working with young women here in that phase of their lives who are trying to make sense of their own Muslim identity. And so once, for me personally, once I can answer a question to, you know, satisfaction, to my own personal satisfaction, I lose interest in it a little bit. So that's why I haven't dived into this a bit further, because to me it seems like the depiction of heavenly beings is much different in the Quran than I was finding in other sources, kind of just casually perusing them. And so as soon as I established for myself that there was, as we might call it, a particular, you know, male lens on this topic, you know, and then I could bring maybe what we might call a female lens or my own lens to it, then I was more inclined to feel satisfied that I had at least answered the question to my own satisfaction anyway. Mm-hmm. That's maybe a selfish way to do scholarship, but you know, we have short lives and we have to kind of pursue what's the most interesting.
Yeah. You know, I was going to wait until, since the word Hud has come up a few times now, I was going to wait until later to ask a question about specific content of the book. But now that we're here, I would love for us to just continue this and talk about the Hud a bit more to address a question that I had in mind. When we're talking, it was one of my most favorite discussions of the book. I'm very interested in the idea of, for me, it's also a question of what's at stake. Why does God care so much about, you know, X, Y, Z? But one of the more convincing parts of the book for me was this question of the Hur and this idea of the beings in heaven and whether they're sexed and feminine and whether virginity is a feminine trait and so on. And you argue that dahur, with all the various words for them, so the relevant terms, you know, something like kawaib or wildan mukhalladun or abkar and dahur and so on, whether these terms are necessarily inherently, literally feminine, grammatically and so on. I like the distinction that you make between sensuous and sexual beings, and that these beings are sensuous. Can you walk us through this conclusion of yours that the sensuous beings of heaven are actually not necessarily feminine, and that no term that actually there's no term used in these verses that would linguistically and literally amount to a maiden, you know, crushing sadly the hearts of many people who are fooled, you know, fooled humans amongst us. But can you go ahead and talk to us more about this feminine, this non feminine beings after all?
So what I'm doing is I'm trying to make a distinction between human beings, which are a specific category of beings that inhabit this earth, and eschatological beings, which are not human. You know, there's no insan in described by the Quran as being in paradise. It's all the nafs. There's lots of nafs in paradise. And so if we think about the term nafs, it's most frequently in the Quran gendered female. And so if you have descriptions of heavenly beings and they are not, you know, they're described in you know, using this word, but as nafs, and then it would make sense that some of them have feminine adjectives. And there's also this category like the wildan. And, it, you know, if we're looking at Arabic grammar, we know that collective plurals can, you know, be gender inclusive here. So I'm also kind of playing with this idea of wildan being, you know, all of these heavenly beings are in this new kind of I'm trying to translate the word like abkar, like fresh state, this virginal state, like not thinking about virginity as literally having a hymen or having not had sexual intercourse before, but as being virginal in the sense of being new and a new creation, which the Quran uses that kind of imagery of. And so I'm trying to just probe a little bit deeper, you know, again, reading the Quran sort of in its own terms about who precisely are these beings, that it's pretty clear some of them are former souls that have been, you know, brought forth in this newly created state. And you know, in that exploration, the Quran certainly has innuendos that are very sexualized to, you know, describe the interactions between these beings. And one of the things I found fascinating was that there's descriptions of lots of food in paradise, and there's, you know, specific descriptions of the people in paradise consuming this food and taking great pleasure in consuming this food. And there's also a parallel then between, you know, potentially sexual relations is also, you know, one of the pleasures of paradise, but the Quran does not, you know, promise that. And some people might say that, oh, well, that's a certain ethic of modesty coming through. But then I also showed that if you look at other verses that talk about sexuality in the Quran and sexual congress and interaction between human beings, you find that, yes, sometimes the Quran speaks in innuendos, but sometimes it's very direct. And so I don't know that kind of a modesty question would really come into play when other verses certainly discuss the issue of sex and sexuality very directly.
One of the topics that you take up here is that, you know, is that of Yusuf and Zuleika, who of course isn't named. And you observe that the only mention of sexual exploitation or assault involves a woman assailant, which seems really significant. And I wanted to ask if you could say more about this and, you know, what this might mean and how do we as contemporary humans living in an age of Me Too deal with something like this?
Yeah, my thinking in this came out of a panel that I was asked to sit on a while back for the Journal of Feminist Studies and Religion, looking at sexual violence in sacred texts. And I was sort of anchoring part of the Muslim response to this question. And so I noticed that you do have the story of the angels and the mob, that the angels that come to Abraham and Lut, and the mob that wants to force itself themselves onto the angels. So there's that one mention of kind of a sexual assault type of situation. But then it's, if you actually look at what story actually has figures interacting in this way, you find that with Zuleika's proposal, in a very clear manner, Joseph is saying no. And I think that I use this story when I teach in, more devotional contexts as well, to think about what consent means, and to also, reread this story as not just a woman kind of in insinuating, forcing herself upon a man, which might be, in our experience, it might be that the opposite is actually true, in that most of sexual assault, cases involve, a male perpetrator and a woman victim or survivor. I think that not having the trauma, in a way, of reliving an assault, if you're a woman coming to the Quran and you have experienced that trauma in your life, and you're, just standing in Tarawih prayer, it could be a bit more traumatizing to have it be a woman, who's the on the victim side, given that that's the case that's so much more prevalent in human history, if I can just kind of guess at it in that broad sweep. And so I think that there's a way to read this in a literary lens, but I think there's also some potential here for the story as to be read in kind of this context of morality as well, and thinking what lessons are there to open up this conversation in contemporary Muslim context, because it's a conversation that needs to be had, in a practical sense in contemporary communities, and to be able to open it through a story, I think, is a really helpful way. And, the story, again, as it's told, it's potentially less re-traumatizing to women who are more likely to actually have experienced this type of unwanted sexual advance.
One of the primary arguments that you make in this book is that, the Quran doesn't provide any one exact, there's no archetypal woman in the Quran. There's, women aren't, just good or just bad, or, one way or another. They're essentially human, right? So they're complex. They make mistakes. They're problematic. They're virtuous. They're bad and they're good and so on. But we do have stuff like, and I loved these, basic facts that you mentioned here and there, which I think are so significant. And I wanted to say, tell me more about this. But one of the points that you make, for example, is that the point of the portrayal of daughters in the Quran, or of sisters in the Quran. So there are no corrupt daughters, for instance, you point out, and there are no conflicts mentioned between sisters. What does this mean, though? And I mean, here I'm thinking, oh, crap, how could the patriarchy exploit something like this? Because, oh, look, how this just means that women are, inherently compassionate and good, and they avoid conflict and so on, which at the same time, the patriarchy also doesn't think that way of women. So I would love to hear your thoughts. Like, what does it mean that this is how it looks like the Quran is portraying sisters and daughters?
Yes, and mothers too, right? Because you have mothers who maybe make some mistakes. Like, there's a mother in a parable who, with her husband, prays for a child and then essentially you know, forgets her piety. And there's stories in which mothers are censured. So Noah, his wife, presumably, you know, she has children, or at least Noah's children are mentioned in other verses, but you never see a woman, you know, interacting with her children in a morally reprehensible way, whereas you do have a figure like Abraham's father, you know, threatening to stone him for, you know, having different different theological convictions. So, yeah, what do we do with that? Sometimes as I was working on this manuscript, I would immediately see the, you know, potential relevance of such an observation. And at other points, you know, any given observation, and at other points I could just observe something and I wasn't exactly sure myself, you know, what is the meaning of this, or what meaning could I ascribe to this? And really that the question about, you know, no corrupt mothers, you know, interacting directly with their children, and no corrupt sisters, no corrupt daughters. On the one hand, there's less women figures mentioned. And, you know, in my work on the men and gender in the Quran, I'm trying to get a precise number of how many male figures I would count, as I did with the women figures, but there's definitely less women, but still I'm kind of left at, I don't know what to do with that necessarily. So I welcome anybody out there who has ideas about that. It's certainly a topic for more exploration.
Yeah, no, for sure. And related to that also, you have a very important point about the ways that women figure in Meccan surahs and Medinan ones. So you suggest that their stories serve as lessons for the early emerging Muslim community. You note that the Quran begins with negative examples, and I loved this fact as well, that it begins with negative examples of Meccan in Meccan surahs, but transitions into more positive ones, which you call a chronological arc of revelation, I believe it was. Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, so I'm reading through primarily three different lenses. So one is just the Mus'haf, you know, reading from the Fatiha till the surahs at the end. Another way is to read the revelatory order, which of course isn't precise. It's a debated order, but at least the general arc is pretty much agreed on both in Orientalist Western scholarship on the Quran, as well as in devotional scholarship on the Quran. So there, I just basically took that general arc and read the Quran in that revelatory order. And then there's also the order of sacred history, which of course the Quran doesn't give per se, but that can be understood. Again, this is something that I would have to go to extra Quranic sources to understand, but, you know, kind of how do the different prophetic families relate to one another in an overarching sequence. But in terms of reading the revelatory order, and again, I'm careful in the book to say that this is not a, you know, precise science, that this is, you know, I'm just taking a general arc that has broadly been established. But we do find that the figure of, like, the wife of Abu Lahab is the first and really only Meccan woman to be condemned in such harsh terms. Later on, we find that the wife of Nuh and the wife of Lot, the wife of Noah and Lut, are also condemned, damned to hell in very explicit terms. And those are the only figures that you find that are in those explicit terms damned. And so I do see that when we read the arc, the Quran goes from these early descriptions of human beings originating from this one soul that is then bifurcated, and that concept continually comes back. We find that the concept of this damned woman, you know, comes in Abu Lahab, in the verses on Abu Lahab that are very early in the arc of Revelation. And again, that idea of damned woman comes pretty consistently because the wife of Lut is mentioned with some regularity, especially throughout the late Meccan and early Medinan period. But then by the time we get to the later Quranic verses, it's really focused on women who are bringing specific questions about their status to, you know, to bear. And these are stories like the women who are tested for their loyalty, you know, the woman who has an issue with her husband, and the Quran, you know, hears her complaints. And so you get a different perspective on women's issues, if we can say it that way. By the time we get to the end of the Quran, it gets much more granular and much more responsive in a way to specific questions that, you know, presumably women are bringing to the Prophet Muhammad, that the Quran is then, you know, from a devotional understanding, responding to. There's a definite development and a definite arc. And in the middle of all that, from the mid to late Meccan period into the early Medinan period, are all the biblical shared figures, which is, you know, relevant at a time when you have an emerging Islamic polity that is establishing itself in relationship to Jewish and Christian specifically polities. So in a way, the arc of how and where women figures appear makes a lot of sense when you look at accounts of Sirah and accounts of the development of the early polity.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about women's speech in the Quran. What sorts of themes and tropes do we see there?
Oh, there's a lot there. When I started counting the verses, I was particularly taken really by the fact that the Quran does include quite a number of verses that are women speaking, and a good number of those are women praying. And the most prolific figure in the Quran in terms of numbers of verses that contain her speech is the Queen of Sheba, who is a, you know, I have a chapter on...
Which can I say was a surprise to me, because I would have expected Maryam to have...
Yeah, so in terms of the number of verses, Maryam, the Queen of Sheba, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, has 8. Zuleika has 6, and Maryam has 5. So the Queen of Sheba is, of course, a figure who is not part of a prophetic family, does not have any specific relation to another male figure, you know, other than those people in her council, in her advisory council. And so you have, you know, not only a figure that is empowered in a political sense, but also one that's asserting her presence through her speech as well.
Right, for sure. And how do Muhammad's wives figure in the Quran?
Yeah, so this, I looked at this in some depth, as you might might expect.
Right.
And I was not only looking at prominent figures who are mentioned somewhat frequently in the Quran, but I was also looking at these more passing references. And so I not only noticed references to the wives, but also to the daughters. There's a few verses that reference the daughters and other figures as well. Mm-hmm. There's other daughter figures as well that might not come to people's mind right away as being mentioned, but several prophetic figures are interacting with their daughters. Lut, of course, has this, verses where he mentions his daughters, and there's other mentions as well. And so I was thinking not only about the relationship between prophetic figures and their spouses, you know, of which there's many couples in the Quran to look at, but when it comes to, you know, I was looking at daughters as well. And specifically when it came to the family of the Prophet Muhammad, I was looking at the ways in which the depictions of his family compare and contrast to other prophetic families. And there's a lot to be, you know, I found quite a bit to comment on in there, but maybe some of the most interesting would be my trying to tease out this distinction between the use of the term as wedge for the prophet's wives, and then also the idea of niset and nabi. Niset, you know, being women broadly, meaning women, presumably women of the household. And what I try to say, a lot of past commentators have taken niset and nabi to mean specifically wives, and it's translated like that in many English translations anyway. And I try to make the case that niset and nabi is actually referring to the women of the prophet's family more broadly. And I make that case like looking at Surat al-Ahzab. But yeah, it's these like small interventions that I'm trying to make a linguistic argument for that might not have a whole like lot of cumulative impact, but it is in a sense a reprioritization, if you will, of the actual Quran, and you know what information it could give us about any number of topics, you know, whether as scholars or as practicing Muslims.
You know, I just remember there's you have a discussion in the book where you talk about how the family and women's bodies figure in the end times, right? So as signs of the end times, the loss of the family or something happening to the female body, or you know, a woman having a miscarriage and such, or sort of very, very symbolic things that are very real. Why can you tell our audience about that and what you as sort of the loss of the family as punishment, the specific references to female bodies, the woman's body as signs of end times.
Yes, so that one of the signs of the end times mentioned specifically in the Quran that, you know, women will lose what they're carrying, and I was thinking about this primarily in a pastoral lens and how devastating that experience, I've seen that experience be for women, and to think about, you know, the horror of end times as. You know, the female body itself has this particular response to the terror of end times that, you know, I think it's not just about the affect on the body, but also the you know, psychological, emotional trauma that can go with that experience. And part of my methodology for approaching the Quran, at least in the devotional circles in which I'm also kind of operating, is to help people sink a bit deeper into particular meanings, to kind of slow down and let the Quran have an affective, you know, an affective, let ourselves have an affective response. And right. I think there's also a modality of writing about the Quran in Islamic studies, and Karen Bauer is certainly doing this as well as are other people, to use thinking about what is the desired affective response, you know, of particular assertions in the Quran, and I think that's one where the Quran is using this very specific, you know, female experience, and while it's devastating too for partners, there's the immediate impact of, you know, having a miscarriage is on, you know, the female herself, and so it's communicating in a way through this, you know, deeply feminine experience, you know, in this affective way, this point about end times. And so that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to slow down the reading a little bit and maybe you know, especially for Muslims who have just been exposed to the Quran their whole lives, to maybe show some different perspectives on verses.
It was really powerful. I want to talk about positionality, which you engage with in the book, in the beginning of the book, when you're discussing the challenges of writing an academic book as a practicing devotional Muslim. Can you tell us more about some of these challenges and why something like an assertion of your identity and beliefs is necessary or important or constructive in academic works?
Yeah, so unlike some of my, male mm-hmm. presenting colleagues, I can't, because I'm wearing a scarf, it's more obvious that I come from a devotional Muslim perspective. And so when I'm in academic circles, you know, because of just the legacy of ascribing particular meanings to a headscarf or just looking at Muslim women's agency in derogatory ways, I'm always coming up against, you know, I'm not given the benefit of the doubt as a scholar or, you know, as a practicing Muslim, you know, who does affiliate in devotional circles. There's a bit of a suspicion as well around Islamic studies in the academy, and, you know, sometimes rightly so. And the, you know, those two suspicions about being, you know, a woman who's a practicing Muslim in the academy, and having to navigate those two spaces, trying to make a mark, trying to say how my work brings something to bear for Quranic studies when it's done in a secular modality, and also trying to assert that I might have something valuable to bring in devotional Muslim circles where authority is more often religious authority and scholarship are more often, you know, gendered in a more masculine way. And so, you know, from in either space, whether in the academy or whether in Muslim devotional circles, it's a struggle might not be the right word, but it's definitely, you know, my authority or the value that I bring is intrinsically questioned. And part of what I try to do in the introduction of this book is to reassert the value of paying attention to women's voices in devotional spaces and, you know, paying attention to people who come to Quranic studies, you know, with a different, you know, set of formative, you know, theological lenses. And it remains to be seen how convincing that is, or how much of an impact in either one of those spaces that I'm able to make, given that I'm straddling both of them somewhat precariously.
As we close, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we end?
Yeah, you know, I get emails sometimes from Muslim women who are thinking about an academic path as a potential career. And I think I'd just like to add on a note of encouragement to those women in particular who are thinking, could the academy be a place for me ultimately to, you know, deepen my exploration of Islamic studies and, you know, my own, you know, their own journey to understand Islamic texts and traditions. So I'd just like to end with that encouragement for people out there that there's more and more space opening up, I think. And not only is there more space maybe opening up for creative academic works, even if there's not necessarily a lot of space for like tenure track jobs, I think there's a lot of community impact that we need people who are educated in historical critical methods and in the perspectives that can be brought to the table by Islamic studies frameworks. And so I just wanted to say that this, as much as this joining between perspectives can be difficult and can kind of force you at times to rethink things from a devotional lens or from, you know, to rethink or re-navigate scholarship and kind of some of the rough edges and the prejudices in Islamic studies context in the academy, that it's worth it and that there's so much need out there on a practical level that I'd really encourage people to go into the field.
For sure. Same here. And as we close, we like to ask our authors to tell us a little bit about any work they're doing currently, which you've mentioned, and I'm so thrilled about it, that we can look forward to in the near future, inshallah.
Yeah, so I have that work on men in the Quran a little bit on the back burner right now because I'm working on a project that's forthcoming from Cambridge University Press, a shorter book in a series of looking at religion and perspectives on monotheism. So I'm writing a contribution from an Islamic studies perspective, looking at the intellectual tradition and the ways in which monotheism is understood from an Islamic perspective. And for me, this is, you know, not in gender studies at all, which has primarily been my wheelhouse for a while. But it's given me this chance to maybe go back to the fundamentals a little bit more. And while I'm still doing really close Quranic studies textual analysis for this particular project, I think it's helpful for me to, you know, pull back and go to such a more foundational concept. Whereas my work on gender, you know, was able to touch on kind of core, you know, core aspects of creed, but it was a bit more niche, if you will. So I'm excited for this next project and to be in dialogue with other scholars that are not specifically writing on gender.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. That's all the questions that I had. And I enjoyed this very much. And I'm so grateful you made time for us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. So that was my conversation with Celine Ibrahim, where she discusses her new book, Women and Gender in the Quran, published with Oxford University Press in 2020. Thank you so much for listening and stay safe. Salam.